Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Now, we are out of the, well, what people think of as the Reformation month. We're into November, although, you know, the Reformation did go on past October 31st. And Luther's posting the 95 Theses. That was just the beginning. In fact, it began really before that in a lot of ways. And we're going to be talking about someone who is instrumental in the career and the life of the reformer, Martin Luther. His friend, his promoter, his father confessor, one of several, Johann von Staupitz. You might have heard the name if you've read any Reformation history. We'll find out how influential this man was in Luther's life and career during the last 40 minutes of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Timothy Dost is our guest. He's assistant professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Dr. Dost, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
First of all, let's establish one of the more problematic roles for people understanding that Staupitz had to Luther, and that is a father confessor. What was this relationship formally between these two men?
Well, Staupitz had actually quite a broad role of supervisor and superior to Luther, and one of his roles as a supervisor was that Luther could come to him and talk to him about his sins and things that were on his mind. And Staupitz was supposed to be able to provide ready answers according to the medieval sort of methods of confession and absolution. And Luther availed himself of Staupitz because Staupitz had, I would say, a little bit different view of grace and faith than most of the medieval people who surrounded him. So Staupitz provided some unique points of view, and also, of course, was a person who was interested in having Luther succeed. And so he took personal attention where some other confessors might not have. There were some people around who did confessing or did the listening to confessions quite regularly. Staupitz would have been a bit of a special case for Luther.
Tell us about how these two men, Luther and Johann von Staupitz, first became acquainted with one another.
Staupitz actually was interested in Luther's career. And in order for Luther to become a person who was both a monk and a priest, would have required special permission. And Staupitz probably met Luther in a way that meant something. Not some sort of formal quick meeting, maybe at an ordination or installation kind of thing, but in a way that had meaning. When Staupitz perhaps interviewed Luther for becoming a priest as well as being a monk. So there was a bond that was established at this time, probably about 1506, and he saw a lot of potential in Luther. It did approve his ability to be a priest as well as a monk. Luther is sort of on the unique side. Luther is a priest, he is a monk, he is a doctor of theology, and he's a professor. And so that puts him in four camps where most people in the Middle Ages would have been just maybe one or two camps.
So being a monk would not necessarily have meant ordination to the priesthood. Being a priest would not necessarily have meant having been a member of a religious order. And certainly above and beyond that, being both a professor and a doctor of theology at the University of Wittenberg wouldn't have come naturally to either of those two roles.
Right, even though the doctor of theology did come later.
Let's talk about their relationship, and you have mentioned several times here that Staupitz functions in a lot of ways in Luther's career as a promoter or an advocate for Luther. What was it that you what do you think Staupitz saw in Luther, wherein he said, this guy has some potential, and later led to Staupitz's advocacy for Luther in some pretty crucial moments of his career?
Well, I think one of the things Staupitz saw was the seriousness of Luther, that he was serious about his vows. And he also saw Luther's great potential intellectually. Luther already had sort of a master's of liberal arts when he entered the monastery, so he was far along in terms of his secular academic credentials. In fact, he had been admitted to the highest highest level of studies in the law. So Luther is well versed in Latin. Of course, being German, he's well versed in German. He is well educated for his day. And I don't think Staupitz is going to let a bright young man who has happened to take vows as a monk and also has happened to take now is being admitted to the priesthood, that he's going to let such a bright young man just sort of squander his talents, especially agonizing over sins that Staupitz did not consider that significant.
What was this view that Luther found in Staupitz as a father confessor? You mentioned a somewhat unique view of grace and faith that would not have necessarily been the mainstream at this time in the Roman Church. What were these views of Staupitz?
Well, Staupitz's theology actually centers around the doctrine of election, and the doctrine of election is not understood very well by people today, and was not very well understood in that day either. We don't really want to see it here in sort of the Lutheran sense, but or in a Calvinist sense, let's say, but rather in this sort of unique sense Staupitz had it. Staupitz saw it as a cushion, a way you could look at your salvation and see God's gracious plan for your life in every way. And yet you were not to look at predestination, because if you looked at predestination too hard, either you were part of the elect or not part of the elect. And this made for difficulties because you could never be sure where you were. But if you looked at election and you saw that there was evidence in your life of any sort of election, then you could say, well, God is probably also working in the areas of predestination and justification for me. And so it was a way of granting comfort to souls that had a great deal of agony with regard to the medieval system of confession. Let me say this also, and this is kind of technical as well, but Staupitz did not give up on this medieval idea that was expressed by another theologian named Gabriel Biel, who's an important medieval theologian, but especially important for Lutherans, because he sort of sparks things that allow the Reformation to go forward in terms of attitude, at least. And Biel, the thing Biel contributes is this idea of doing all that is within you. As long as you're doing all that is within you, God will regard that as enough. And so the problem with Luther is that he both knew that he was not doing all that was within him, because he still got, you know, 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night.
Mm-hmm.
And he also knew that his sins were still with him, and he did not feel any comfort from this. So while Staupitz could take him halfway, Staupitz couldn't get him the rest of the way.
So here comes young Luther, burdened by his sin to the point of neuroses, severe neuroses. He is beside himself at some points because of his own guilt. He comes to Staupitz, and Staupitz would say, and he would confess sin. Staupitz would say, well, stop worrying about that. Are there any good works? And Luther would come back and say, this is obviously hypothetical, well, maybe it's certainly not what a righteous God would demand. So it sounds as though Staupitz's comfort was not only the kind of comfort that Luther needed, but it was falling short in a real way for Luther.
Well, I think the real issue is that Staupitz did not get at the doctrine of justification. He mentions it, he uses it, but he does not use it in the way Luther would, in the sense of forensic justification, in the sense of a radical break, being able to say, I am unrighteous, but God has declared me righteous, therefore there is a change that occurs. And in this change I have a new nature, I am justified, and even if I have a sinful nature, then, well, that's something I have to wait with. It's sort of a dual kind of way, sinner and saint, until the day of my death.
So what was Staupitz's view of faith? That kind of covers grace to a certain degree, but what was his view of faith?
Well, I would say that Staupitz would probably follow the medieval view that faith would be something that would be substantial. There would be it would not be so much relational, and that again would be a problem, because Luther had to get to a point where faith was primarily trust rather than something you could have more or less of. And I can't really answer the question for Staupitz, because Staupitz's theology tended to get at the complexities of grace. But Luther would have to work out this idea that faith would have to be a kind of a trust of the heart and a kind of a relational kind of thing with God, rather than being something that you could have more or less of, like be a quart low on faith, or I need a quart more, or I'll go do some prayers and get some more faith, or things like this.
Let's talk about some of those crucial points at which Staupitz not so much steps in, but is there and playing a role in Luther's career. What's the first one beyond, you mentioned the interview to become both a priest and a monk that is probable to have taken place between the two men. Where else is Staupitz crucial at a turning point in Luther's career?
Well, first of all, Staupitz sees to it that Luther gets a full ride scholarship, basically. The prince who has established his young university right around 1500, I think maybe the date's 1502, has established sort of a unique university. Wittenberg is kind of a, well, I think the Pope would kind of view it as a monster, because Wittenberg is established by secular authority. It's not established by papal charter. So it's sort of, it's in a way, it's kind of like your local community college. It's completely different from something that's under the clerical authority. One of the people who goes to Wittenberg is Staupitz, but Staupitz gets so busy with the problems he has being the head of the local Augustinians that he knows he won't be able to handle the tasks of being the Bible scholar at Wittenberg, which is his chair. His position at Wittenberg is in the Bible. And so what he does is he tells Luther, I've made all the arrangements, you're going to become a doctor of the Bible. And Luther complains that he has so much work to do already that he will die if he does this. And Staupitz's sort of maybe apocryphal but maybe true remark, we're not quite sure on this, is, well, then God has room for able men in heaven. So there's no problem. If you die, you will go serve God directly. And if you don't die, then you will serve on earth. And I think Staupitz views this as a way of handling, and he wouldn't use this term, but handling some of the obsessive-compulsive issues with regard to Luther being completely mired in the sin, you know, his anxiety, his difficulties.
Put him to work, in other words.
Put him to work, make him work so hard he doesn't have time to worry about his problems.
There's a scene in the Luther movie that came out about a year ago, if I'm not mistaken, between young Luther and Staupitz. It takes place out in a garden someplace, and he makes the announcement, I've made all the arrangements, you're going to Wittenberg. But he begins by asking him the question, have you ever read the Bible? And I'm wondering if this, and Luther says, no. He's a monk, he's a priest, and he answers no to the question of whether he ever read the Bible. Could this be, I mean, is this apocryphal? Could Luther be ignorant of reading Scripture at this point?
Well, no, I think that's probably true, but I think it's a theatrical shortcut. While it's true Luther probably had not read the Bible to this point, although he had listened to it at lunch and, you know, at the meals they would read the Psalms and things like this, and he had become acquainted with some of it through the monastic worship. It's definitely, and he was one of the monks who really understood Latin, so he understood what was being said. It is true he made no systematic study of the Bible until he began to embark on his studies at Wittenberg. Well, first at Erfurt, and then I think at Wittenberg. The point is, I think in the movie they're compressing things.
But it's safe to say that prior to his formal studies to be an instructor in the Bible at the University of Wittenberg, he had not made any intense study of Holy Scripture.
Right. But he did start his studies at Erfurt.
Okay.
Just to make that clear.
All right. So he goes, Luther goes to take this position in Wittenberg. Where else does Staupitz, where's the next place that Staupitz is instrumental in Luther's career?
Well, there's an occasion, again depicted in that movie, there's an occasion where there's a dispute between the various monks. The Augustinians are divided into two branches. You might want to consider one sort of the kind of loosey-goosey Augustinians, or the conventuals. They're not quite with the program. You could kind of be a rich kid and feel kind of good about this. Maybe it's sort of like the minimum security prison kind of situation. They're not imprisoned, obviously, but, you know, it's because sometimes it comes kind of close. You
it
know?
Was Augustinian monkery as a hobby.
Yeah, or, okay. You know, for the second and third offspring you couldn't give any land to, you'd get them into one of these cloisters, which were pretty nice places. And then there were the observant Augustinians who were, you know, more rigorous in their approach. And they were very serious about what they did. And there are a couple of disputes that occur between the observants and the conventuals. The observants would like the conventuals to get with the program and be really Augustinian, whereas the conventuals would like to have the money that the observants have piled up in order to balance their books. And so there's this kind of dispute, and I think it's Giles Viterbo who's down in Rome. I can't remember the exact figure, but I think that's who it is. They go down, a couple of monks are sent from Wittenberg and some other places to represent their order. And one of them is a man named Natin, who goes with Luther down to Rome in 1511. And I think they leave in 1510 in December and arrive in 1511. And Luther is seen as quite rigorous here. He defends things quite well. And this is, of course, his famous trip to Rome, where he gets to see how rushed the Italians are about their masses and how irreverent things are. And you know, he gets to see all the problems with,
the indulgences and the
brothels for priests, all kinds of things. There are all kinds of problems in Rome. So there are indulgence issues as well. There's all kinds of issues, and Luther leaves thoroughly disgusted.
So he goes to Rome on the occasion of making a defense of the more observant branch of the Augustinian order, and finds a Rome that he never imagined would be there.
Right. Well, he thinks he's going to go for a piety session, and he's extraordinarily disappointed, because not only can he not practice his piety in a serious manner, but he finds nobody there practicing piety in a serious manner.
We're talking about Martin Luther's father, confessor, friend, and promoter, Johann von Staupitz. Dr. Timothy Dost is our guest. On this day, the church remembers Staupitz in its calendar. Dr. Timothy Dost is assistant professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Our call-in numbers, if you have a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our conversation continues until about 5:45 when we sign off early here in November. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. You had mentioned before we came on the air that Heidelberg was an important point at which Staupitz and Luther are together, or Staupitz has a contribution to make. Tell us about that.
Well, after Luther posts theses in September. He doesn't post those on the door, but he publishes theses on scholastic theology. They're 97 theses. Then he publishes his 95 theses, probably posts them on the door, but, you know, that's not necessarily 100% certain. He definitely mailed them to his bishop. He spreads them around through the various humanists in the area, so he wants to debate these things, and he's really, doing a good job with these theses. There's kind of a lull. Everybody says kind of quiet down, Luther, and take it easy, because people know how the reaction to Luther's theses is going. And Staupitz is one of the people who kind of says, cool it. We're going to have a meeting of the Augustinians 1518 anyway. why don't you be the presenter at Heidelberg? And arranges for him to be the presenter. So, in addition to the kinds of other things that Staupitz arranged, among them Luther getting his doctoral degree, Luther getting a position as a teacher of the Bible, Staupitz also arranges to see to it that Luther is the primary speaker at a place where he has a chance to defend himself, to bring out his theology in positive terms. The 95 Theses are not very positive. The 95 Theses are mostly about a specific problem in the medieval Catholic Church. And, I mean, if you read them, they're not even all that Lutheran in some ways. You look at them, they're about this specific medieval problem. There are a lot of things about the Pope.
And Luther is still very much a son of Rome when he writes them.
Right. He's very complimentary to the Pope. He says the Pope must not know about this. This is all wrong. So, at any rate, what ends up happening is Luther ends up going to Heidelberg, and things work out very, very well.
This is where he pens the famous Heidelberg theses on the theology of the cross and then on some philosophical issues. Is that correct?
Right.
What about what Luther said there in his theology of the cross, or to be more accurate, the theologian of the cross versus the theologian of glory, puts Luther's theology in a positive way, as you said before?
Well, what Luther says is that there are those who are of the cross and those who are of glory. What he means by this is that we can derive our theology from sort of the things we see around us, and look for signs and wonders, and look for evidence in creation, and look for things that we would consider to be the glory of God. Maybe look into our own lives and say, well, if I'm successful, God is with me, and if I'm not successful, God isn't. This would be kind of theology of glory language. And theology of the cross would say, whether I'm successful or not, or whether it looks like God is in the universe or not, or whether God of power is someone I can love or not, I find at the cross the love of Jesus Christ that overcomes all these things, and that demonstrates that God's love is there in weakness and in foolishness and in other things that don't quite look like the glory that some people esteem.
With only 30 seconds here, is this a place at which Luther begins to depart from Staupitz on the whole issue? Staupitz says, you want to know about your election. Are you showing any evidence in your life of election, so don't worry. With this theology of the cross, it sounds as though Luther is saying the evidences in your life may be completely contrary to what the cross says. Yet the cross speaks louder.
Right. And I think he's not contrasting himself with Staupitz. Rather, he's amplifying a point Staupitz hadn't considered.
When we come back from this break, 10 more minutes left with Dr. Timothy Dost. We're talking about Martin Luther's father, confessor, friend, and promoter, Johann von Staupitz, here on Issues, Etc. If you have a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Timothy Dost is Assistant Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths into the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly contributor to Issues, Etc. To find out how you can become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, check out page 8 of the latest Issues, Etc. journal, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, grace, faith, scripture, for the sake of Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues, Etc., and you.
Cicadas, the singing fossil.
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, we just recently experienced the emergence of millions of what are called 17-year cicadas right here in northern Kentucky. Now, their singing was quite loud, but what do you mean, though, by singing fossils when we're talking about cicadas?
Well, in preparing for our cicada plague, one of our staff was researching cicadas and found photos of several fossils of them. One photo said the fossil was supposedly over 65 million years old. Now, in the photos, you could easily identify the fossil as a cicada, complete with head, eyes, body, wings, and the organ which the female uses to lay her eggs. Remarkably, this fossil cicada looked very similar to the same cicadas that recently kept everyone awake here at night. This is just another example of what we call a living fossil. It's an organism found in the fossil record that is still living today and is virtually unchanged. But if evolution were true, you'd expect them to have changed a great deal in 65 million years. Actually, they haven't changed much at all, because they were created only 6,000 years ago to reproduce their own kind, as it says in Genesis.
When you read Ken Ham's free booklet, Why Is There Death and Suffering?, you'll discover that you can't believe in millions of years of death and suffering before Adam. For some fascinating insights, log on to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Have you ever watched a commercial on TV and thought, what are they advertising? Then 25 seconds into a 30-second commercial, they finally mention the name of the product. Such advertisements are using a technique called emotional transfer. The point of the first 25 seconds is to simply make you feel good. Then they hope you will associate that good feeling with their product the next time you see it at the store. Charmin and Little Debbie love to use this technique. Teach your children that cute babies and cuddly animals have nothing to do with the quality of a product. Pray with your children that the Lord would make your family good stewards of His gifts. He loved you enough to die on the cross for you. He will also give you wisdom in how you spend His money at the store. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Here's a happy AM850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Monday, November 8th, 2004, Joe and Lee Enders. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM850 KFUO in thanks and praise to God as Joe and Lee start their new life together. Once again, we say thank you to Joe and Lee Enders of St. Louis, today's AM850 KFUO day sponsors.
At last count, we have 69 so far signed up as members of our Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly donor program. That means 69 people are either confessors, apologists, or reformers giving at that level on a regular basis to Issues Etc. This Reformation Club is crucial for us not only to be quite frank with you, count on a steady source of income to Issues Etc. to help not only maintain but advance the gospel outreach of Issues Etc. across the nation, but also it is a way in which people can kind of structure their giving. Now, our goal, we have 69 so far this year. We'd like to have 100 by year end as members of our Issues Etc. Reformation Club, either at the level of the confessor, that's $25 a month, or a year-end gift of $250. The level of the apologist, that's $50 a month, or a year-end gift of $500, or at the level of the reformer, $100 a month, or a year-end gift of $1,000. There are all sorts of benefits and ways that we thank those we have Issues Etc. journal subscriptions. We have tapes of the month. We have books that we give to those who support us at each one of these levels. We have transcripts for those who are reformers as well. You can find out all about this at our website, issuesetc.org, and you can also sign up to be a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer by donating online, issuesetc.org. We also have a toll-free number. It's our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. Or if you prefer, you can mail us a check at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. We'd like to have 100 by year end. Dr. Timothy Dost is our guest. We're talking about Johann von Staupitz, Luther's father confessor, his friend, his promoter. And in many ways, it sounds as though Staupitz is also, Dr. Dost, not someone who just sees the potential of Luther, but someone who is intent upon, as you said before, not allowing Luther to either waste his life worrying about his sins or waste his life tucked away in a monastery someplace.
Right. I think he gives Luther a significant boost in terms of knowing that somebody in the Catholic authority views his views as important and crucial. And so what happens is Staupitz is able to help Luther to realize his potential and does a good job with that.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from St. Louis, Mark is on the line. Mark, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, Pastor Wilkin, this is Mark. How you doing?
Doing well.
Good. Yeah, I might be a little off the subject, but because of the time of the year here, someone was telling me that in liberalism, and maybe the definition changed a lot since the time, but they said Martin Luther was a liberal of his day. And then they also said Jesus was one, too. And I said, well, I guess the definition changed, or maybe it's kind of twisted. I'm not really sure. If you could help me out on that, I don't know if you could do that now.
All right, let's deal with the Luther question here. Dr. Dost, in what sense, if any, could Luther be considered a liberal?
Well, first of all, classic liberalism is a phenomenon of the 19th century. And I think when we use terms like liberal and conservative nowadays, we don't use them in terms of thinking about just straightforward issues of human rights and sort of a positive view of human potential. Today, if we use the term, we usually mean someone who is sort of on the progressive edge of making change in his day. And in that sense, you could argue either way with Luther. You could argue that he is conservative or reactionary even, or you could argue that he's a liberal or a radical. Radical is probably not a good title, actually, because Luther is not interested in tearing things up without rebuilding them, which is more the radical agenda. Luther is interested in reforming things. But if you look at Luther as a reformer, he's interested in reforming things according to very conservative models. And so to call him a liberal is to call him a liberal who wants to go back to what the church was in Jesus' day, not in terms of culture or in terms of structure necessarily, but rather in terms of understanding the grace of Jesus Christ and the love of God and the forgiveness of sins. This was a very, very conservative move in one respect. In another respect, because it was a challenge to authority, it was a liberal move. So there's no way to pigeonhole Luther. You're gonna have to take parts of what he did and put them in one camp and parts in another. And this is one of the problems with putting labels from, you know, that apply 1,800 years later than Christ or 300 years later than Luther to someone who really doesn't live in those times.
Let's talk about another encounter wherein Staupitz played a pivotal role for Luther. And this is Luther is called, either requests or is called, to have an audience before Cardinal Cajetan and, I guess, to be examined for what he had been writing and saying. Tell us about this encounter and what role Staupitz played.
Well, Cajetan was sort of the greatest medieval scholastic scholar of his day. He's one of the really top scholars of the time on this whole business of medieval scholasticism, which is one of the things Luther was challenging. And so Staupitz warns Luther, I guess would be the best word, to be cautious at this time visiting Cardinal Cajetan, and gives him some pointers on how to be submissive and how to conduct a proper interview. Luther looks forward to the interview, thinking that Cajetan will give him a fair hearing. But Cajetan's instructions are not to hear Luther, but simply to get Luther to recant. And this is a problem, because Luther would like to have somebody hear him out and would like to have an answer.
And every time Kyaton tries to get Luther to recant, Luther insists on talking more on the subject that Kyaton doesn't want him to talk about. And after about 2 days, Kyaton is in sort of a fit of rage. I don't know if he's throwing stuff or not, but he's not very happy. And he finally simply dismisses Luther and is ready to use his ecclesiastical power to simply arrest Luther. But there are political complications. And this is when, well, maybe at this time or a little bit later, is when Staupitz actually releases Luther from his vows. So that if Staupitz is commanded to turn Luther over, Luther does not have to obey Staupitz as his superior.
Now, with only a minute here before our conversation concludes, did Staupitz ever feel any heat from the hierarchy of the church at this time for his association with Luther?
Yes. Staupitz, when he dies in 1524, is still on fairly good terms with Luther, although he has moved on from being an Augustinian to a Benedictine. But Staupitz's works are banned by the papacy as part of the Counter-Reformation.
Because of his association with Luther?
Probably.
Would they have been banned had he never known Martin Luther and still written the same things?
Well, I think had he never known Martin Luther, they wouldn't have been a Luther, and they probably also wouldn't have been a Trent. So
they wouldn't have been worried about his writings.
Right, you're asking sort of circular things. Well, if there were no Trent, there would have been no Counter-Reformation. I can't answer that question.
Okay. I'm asking a historian to talk about something other than history. Dr. Timothy Dost, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Dr. Timothy Dost is Assistant Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We've been talking about Martin Luther's friend, Father Confessor Johann von Staupitz. You know, what it does is it highlights, to some degree, you may say, I've never heard of Johann von Staupitz, and that's fine. You've learned a little something in the course of this conversation with Dr. Dost. There are many things taking place in the course of the Reformation, this period of history so pivotal to modern church history. Many things that are taking place behind the scenes that have very little to do with the intentions or the writings or the thoughts of the principal figures. We think of them as Luther and others. Things that are occurring that make, that bring out, if you will, the theology that needs to be articulated at the time of the Reformation. You can call them accidents of history. I seriously doubt that they are accidents, in fact, but the providence of God. God likes to work behind the scenes this way. And although someone can certainly go to their grave never having heard of Johann von Staupitz, one might credit him with nudging Luther in the right direction toward the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.